on the court's agenda, but it could still get there this term in a lawsuit over Harvard's use of race in college admissions. Chief Justice John Roberts, who once firmly guided the court as its ideological center, now has five more conservative justices to his right, with the replacement of liberal icon Ruth Bader Ginsburg by Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Polls show Americans increasingly see the court as partisan rather than an impartial institution. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Saturday set a new deadline of October 31st for the chamber to pass a $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. In a letter, Pelosi said that more time was needed to pass the infrastructure bill along with a larger $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation package. The new timeline comes after House Democratic leadership delayed a vote on the infrastructure bill after progressives threatened to vote it down without an agreement on the sweeping social spending bill that is expected to carry priorities like combating climate change, expanding Medicare, and new child care and education benefits. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 82 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 68 degrees and foggy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
The time now was 1 minute past 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and
here's some advice for your friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me. Print that story, you're a dead man.
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone. Got a whole lot of police cars with their lights all flashing red.
That's Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges on alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. Before that, the unmistakable voice of Humphrey Bogart playing the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA. He's telling the racketeer, there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins, and I've swiped that fine movie title for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. Last week, I was part of a discussion about the ongoing crisis at Rikers Island, the really terrible conditions that are prevailing there. A bunch of reporters who were covering Rikers were part of the discussion, along with several people who'd worked as administrators over the years, and even people who'd been behind bars there. But one of them was a former commissioner who told about how, during his time basically overseeing Rikers Island, he'd had only two calls from the mayor in the entire time he was in charge. One of them was to complain about the fact that the commissioner was trying to get rid of the geese that were all over the island, destroying the gardens that people imprisoned there had planted. The Port Authority, which is right nearby LaGuardia, regularly gets rid of the geese and because of the safety hazard, and they were helping out at Rikers. But this story had hit the press, and the mayor was responding to public outrage. The former commissioner added that there had been several suicides at Rikers. There had been brutal beatings by officers, but none of those incidents had ever brought a call from City Hall. But killing the geese? That made everyone in City Hall berserk. That was one takeaway. But another takeaway from our discussion were the thoughtful comments by a man named Rob DeLeon, who spent time as a teenager at Rikers. Today, Mr. DeLeon is a leader at the Fortune Society, the wonderful organization for people who've gone through the criminal justice system, an organization formed by WBAI's own David Rothenberg, who hosts two wonderful shows here on our radio station. Rob DeLeon is a senior vice president at the Fortune Society. He oversees programming, and he works on public policy advocacy. And he spoke movingly during our discussion about conditions on Rikers, and I wanted to hear more from him, so I've invited him on this show. Rob DeLeon, welcome to WBAI.
Hey, Tom. Good evening, and thanks for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure and our honor. I wonder if you'd be willing to start just by sharing briefly some of your own story as to how you found yourself on Rikers as a teenager and your own journey since then.
Sure. So again, thanks for having me on, Tom.
Thank you.
You know, my story, of course, is not unique. You know, it's not much different from so many folks who you know, are now professionals in you know, our city, who made mistakes in their lives. So I grew up in a dysfunctional family. Didn't, you know, have mom and dad as, you know, the typical household you maybe see on television and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Where were you living, Rob?
So I'm from Brooklyn. I'm from a pre-hip Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
There
so it
go.
Wasn't always the best place in the world to live.
Right.
Back in the 70s and 80s. And so, you know, I was out in the street at a very young age, and of course made some decisions that weren't the best, but, you know, they were made given, you know, the resources that were at hand and the opportunities. And so, I found myself on Rikers Island the first time I was 15 years old.
Mm.
Now, you know, you were supposed to be 16 to make it to Rikers Island. But at the time I'd been picked up, and I lied about my age thinking that I would go through the system within 24 hours, you know, come home and tell grandma I spent the night at someone's house.
Uh-huh.
But an old warrant came up for me. And so I was remanded and I was on Rikers Island at 15 years old. Where, you know, I just got my first taste of that gladiator school. And, you know, I will say that while no matter what preparation you may think you can do for such an experience, it's just a really shocking, really eye-opening, really, like, horrible experience. And so, you know, in the street, it was almost like a rite of passage, you know, to say, you know, one day you'd be on Rikers Island and, you know, these are the things you'd have to do to survive. But, you know, so I found myself there. I was 15 years old and, you know, found myself defending myself for, you know, the sneakers and the clothes that I had on. But also, you know, I remember talking across the bullpens in the area where you first come in the reception area in the adolescent building in C-74, and because I saw someone I knew, and they were asking me questions and stuff, and I was, you know, just happy to see a familiar face. And I remember being, like, the cell being open. It was nighttime. The cell being open, an officer dragging me out, pulling me to the side, and shaking me up and actually slapping me. I was a 15-year-old kid. And telling me to shut up and stop screaming across the gate. And so, you know, that was, you know, one of my very first experiences being on Rikers Island, then thrown back into the pen and, you know, just, you know, being humiliated and just feeling like, wow, I guess this is, you know, this is what I got to look forward to until I can get out of here, figure my way out of here.
Mm.
You know, I stayed there for about a month, being 15. You know, though my family came, they presented a birth certificate saying that, you know, what my real age was. And, you know, it wasn't until my next court appearance that I was released on my recognizance. But, you know, it's just the kind of place where supervision was lacking. Mind you, I was with, you know, up to 18-year-olds in, you know, bunk bed dorms with 50 individuals on the dorms. You know, a real lack of supervision for, like, what's going on with the kids there. There was no real investment, right, I think is the best way to put it, in, like, getting these kids. There's no better way to put it, right? I was 15, but I think 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds. There was no investment in, like, the fact that mistakes were made, but that there were, you know, years of life,
mm-hmm.
decades of life ahead of the young people that were there to live. And, you know, there was, like, no programming going on. It was just a matter of, you know, coming in, getting with whatever the program was, learning to defend yourself and stand up for yourself, sort of like a, you know, predator or prey kind of mind state. And, you know, looking forward to getting on the phone, talking to your family, and one day getting out of there.
Right.
So that was my earlier experience.
And you told us about, I guess, a later experience where you ran afoul of a couple of guards. You gestured towards your head. And tell us what that encounter was.
Sure. So a couple of years later, I was 17 years old. I was, again, on Rikers Island, this time, you know, facing, you know, some prison time. And I was being escorted from the visit floor to, I was in the special housing unit, which is where the box,
so to speak. Solitary.
We called it the, mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in solitary confinement. We called it the Bing back then.
The Bing, right.
And, as I was walking, I saw some friends on a line, you know, going to the mess hall, and some of them, you know, were saying hello to me, saying what's up, and I was just, you know, gesturing back to say what's up to them, and, you know, speaking back to them, and the officer that was escorting me told me to shut the F up, and so I was young, I was, you know, annoyed by that, I was hot-headed, and I said, don't talk to me like that. And he looked back at me, and he just kind of, like, you know, turned around and kept walking. And, you know, at the end of that line, I said hello to another friend. And we got by, there's these doorways, and we got by one of them. And, you know, he pushed me into it, you know, by the head, and told me that he told me to shut the F up. And when he pushed me that way, like, he grabbed me by the head and, like, pushed me into the area. And, you know, I stumbled. I weighed all of about 135 pounds when I was 17 years old. And I turned around, I pushed him back, and he screamed for another officer to come in, and they jumped me. And so while I was down on the floor and trying to cover up my head, one of them kicked my head, and the other side hit the banister and cracked my head open. And so I still have a scar on my forehead to remind me of that. And there was, like, blood everywhere. Now it's a small scar, but there was a little hole in my head that, like, made the hallway look like a massacre. And, you know, this was because I wanted some respect. I wanted some dignity, and I protested on being told to shut the F up when I was 17 years old.
Right. You know, that's a terrible story, and I'm sorry for what you went through. But it reminds me that most of us who didn't ever spend time locked up in Rikers or in a place like that really don't have a clear sense of just day to day what it's like. You know, we see the movies or the TV shows or read the newspaper accounts, but I wonder if you could just walk us through more or less a typical kind of day at Rikers. I mean, you're there, you're being held pending trial or disposition of your case. Where were you housed, and what would you do during the day?
So there were housing units that were either dormitory style, or there were cell houses where, you know, you locked in for the count and for, you know, to sleep, and you came out of your cell for you know, to go into the rec room to watch television, or to go to, you know, go to the chow hall, etc. And it was really days full of young people. So I'm speaking from the adolescent perspective, because I was in the adolescent house at the time, looking for something to do with your time. And a lot of the time that came out as, you know, mischief. It came out as things that resulted in violence. And so at the time, the phones were, you know, now there's an ID code that you use. You get about 6 minutes on the phone. You know, there are stories, of course, by the people that we serve that say that, you know, individuals would take others, you know, ID cards or whatever it is to take their phone time. And that's something that isn't really monitored. But back then, they were just open phones. And so you had to establish yourself as someone who's, you know, going to stick up for themselves to be able to even get on the phone. I remember one quick little anecdote where I lived in a housing unit. It was Fort Maine, and I was there for about 2 weeks. And, you know, the people that ran the house were friends of mine. I was, you know, I had the ability to get on the phone and stuff. And I remember one day realizing that there was a couple of guys that never came out of their cells. You know, they were afraid, so they would stay in their cells all day, would never come out for recreation, would come out to go eat, would go right back into their cells. And, you know, I said to my friend that ran the house, I said, bro, these guys, I haven't seen them use the phones. I've been here. I've been here 2 weeks. Like, they got families, they got lawyers, they got cases. We got to get them on the phone. And I motivated my friend, and we took action, and we got the logbook from the office. Said, "Oh, we're gonna run phones so that everyone gets on and reaches out to their families and stuff." And so, you know, had I not had that thought, or someone, you know, say, you know, look, these guys are not ever speaking to their families or whatever, those guys could have been there for months without ever touching the telephone. And so, you know, that's just one of the many examples of, you know, what that experience is like.
That's tough. Let me just tell people, this is WBAI-FM. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. But more importantly, we're listening to Mr. Rob DeLeon, who is a vice president at the Fortune Society, one of the great organizations that works with people who have gone through the criminal justice system. Rob, one of the things that Rikers is such a remote spot, you know, and just getting on and off the island is hard. I know it's been hard for me as a reporter. It's tough for family, visitors, attorneys. But then I see the buses coming in down, you know, at the courthouses, and people who are all shackled. Could you just briefly, what's involved with the chains and the lockups every time you get on a bus to go for a hearing at the courthouse? How long does that take, and what's involved with that?
So, you know, when you're on Rikers Island, one of the, you know, what everyone wants the most is to get off of that place, right? Because of just the ingrained stain of just violence and inhumane conditions. And going to court is, you know, a window into what your next steps will be. And a lot of the times, just an adjournment to come back another day. But you're woken up at very early hours, like 4, 5 a.m., to get up, and, you know, folks are herded into the mess hall, and, you know, then calls are made for Brooklyn, the Bronx, et cetera, whichever, locality you're from. And then, yeah, you go into a pen area where there's a bunch of pens. It's rowdy at 6 a.m., and you're shackled and handcuffed. well, not really shackled down to your ankles, but you're handcuffed to one another, and you're herded onto a bus. Then you're taken into the waiting pen areas and the courthouses, where it's just, it's mayhem. It's a rowdy situation. Folks are screaming across to others they're seeing that may be from other housing units or from other buildings on Rikers Island, other jails on the island. And, it's one of the places, actually, where a lot of the violence happened, on those court trips. But, the experience itself of just, daily being, chained and bussed to court to try to figure out, the next step in your fate. 90% of the people on Rikers Island are not convicted of anything.
Right.
So you're there because you're awaiting the outcome of a trial. And, a good deal of the time, it's because folks can't afford, the bails that are set for them, pre-bail reform and stuff. You have folks in on $500 bails who couldn't make it off of Rikers Island. They just languish there for months and years.
Let me ask you about medical care. I mean, you had what you described as a hole in your head from this beating that you took. Is there medical care is available, but hard to get? What is its status at Rikers, or at least when you were there?
So, I know that over time, things may have changed to where the medical professionals working there, made stronger commitments to caring for the individuals who are their patients, but access to getting to that care, is a barrier, right? Signing up for sick call when you're feeling, ill, or if you have a pre-existing condition that you know of and you're trying to go to the clinic to address it. A lot of times the means of getting there is you have to be up very early and ready to go. And the security dictated the movement of whether or not, you get to where you need to go. There are stories of times when, officers had to break up fights and they were hurt. And so they denied individuals, the access because, they were upset. So they were spiting an individual from getting there to get the medical care that they needed. It wasn't like the kind of experience that a human being should be afforded, when they're sick and need to address their needs, their medical needs.
Well, we're going to talk about conditions now, or at least as they're related to you by people you work with and who you visit with. But I'd like to ask you, you did state time, you said, after your second bid at Rikers. You went upstate. And I'm curious how the state facilities that you were in compared to Rikers in terms of conditions, in terms of relations with officers, in terms of medical care, I mean, all the things we just touched about. How did the state facilities compare to Rikers?
So it was more like after my maybe third or fourth stint on Rikers Island that I went to the state. But, state prisons in Rikers Island, they're just like, of course it's more incarceration, but, they're different experiences, whereas the conditions on Rikers Island are, horrible just based on, the awful layout of the place, the awful just what's afforded to you because you're here, awaiting the outcome of the trial. It's like a long stay in a bullpen. And then in the state, when you go away, you have more access to food that you make yourself and those kinds of things. But, then there's a difference, like the makeup of who the staff are. when mm-hmm. when you're in the state penitentiary. So, you know, and depending on how far away from the city you are, you know, there are much less people of color on staff. You know, there's a lot of dynamics where racism plays a part. So, for instance, when I was in state prison, there was, and I'd been in a number of prisons in the 10 years that I spent incarcerated, there were a number of officers that had tattoos of a black baby either on a hook or on a noose. And they were, you know, required, I guess, to wear their jacket over it and not show it during the day. But if you were working somewhere like if one of the incarcerated people was a porter at night in the infirmary or something like that, and the officer feels a little more relaxed or whatever, and, you know, plenty of us have seen them and have seen them in different places. And so, you know, it's a lot easier to get lost when you're in state prison. So, you know, there have been a number of incidents where individuals experienced, like, severe violence, were beaten, you know, unconscious and stuff like that, and family members didn't know what facility you might have been in or what your conditions were, to hear from you in a long time. So, you know, I would say that the tension is a bit thicker when you're in state prison, you know, in a maximum, you know, security facility. I've also been in a number of medium security facilities where the tension is also as thick. And, you know, the same goes in terms of, you know, access to health care and those things. You know, they're available. There's a clinic. You know, if you need to get to an outside hospital because of an absolute emergency, you know, they'll get you to one. But it has to come to that point where it's an absolute emergency. Because, you know, you might be given aspirin mm-hmm. for something that's a much more serious condition.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about these tattoos. I did a number of stories about some of the facilities way upstate, Attica and others, and I talked to a number of people who told me the same story you just told us about seeing these astonishing tattoos of a black baby either on a noose or a hook on people's arms, and I pushed pretty hard with the Department of Corrections folks to, you know, find out, and I was assured that that was just a myth that had been, you know, spread around.
I'm sure that's what you would say. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's something that I've seen with my own eyes, and you know, we discuss amongst ourselves, formerly incarcerated guys who've, you know, experienced it, where, you know, you could still name officers that, you know, you knew that wore the tattoo, and although you didn't like what that stood for, you had to survive.
Right.
And so, you know, you and that officer may have encountered each other and treated that officer with the as cordial as you had to get by in your day-to-day. So it's like, hey, officer such and such, you know, like, we know exactly who these guys are walking around the state with these tattoos. Maybe not anymore if they've since retired, but I'm sure that the you know, that culture hasn't just gone away.
Right. And you mentioned briefly the color of, I mean, as you got further north in the state, that there were just a handful of officers, I think, who were people of color. And that led to racial tension. But it doesn't seem to have been much of an asset in Rikers in terms of the fact that there were a larger number of officers who were people of color there, and yet you still experienced pretty tough conditions and pretty tough treatment at their hands.
Yeah, that's one of those unfortunate realities where, you know, I didn't want my grandmother or, you know, my wife at the time, go figure, I was 17, 18 years old, with a daughter and a wife at the time, or my father, you know, coming to see me because of what they experienced while being processed.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was like being treated like, sheep being herded and just with a real lack of, you know, humanizing regard. So it's an unfortunate truth that, you know, that people that looked like those of us that were there and came from those places, you know, it didn't make much of a difference on this island.
All right. We're going to take a short music break, play a tune that was written about Rikers Island. Warning, it's got some language in it, but I'm told it's okay. Reggie, can we cue this up?
Hysteria, mass production, and mass incarceration. The epitome of huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The masses, masses, the masses, masses. Mass is the property of matter, regardless of the state. But it seems we don't matter until we're properties of the state en masse. And mass is still trying to trick himself into believing he picked cotton too. And no matter how much I kowtow, tap dance, and jump through a bunch of hoops, I'll still be the one who winds up in a jumpsuit. I'll still be the one who winds up with the gun wounds. King had just one dream that won't seem to come true. X had necessary means and a gun, too.
Okay. All right, well, that was another tune, but maybe that's just as well. The show is Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. I'm talking to Rob DeLeon, who was vice president at the Fortune Society. I was talking about his experience at Rikers, and I want to talk about the Fortune Society. How did you come to work there, Rob? When was that, and what happened that you wound up being a vice president at the place?
So I've been at Fortune now for a little over 4 years. I've been doing reentry work, alternatives to incarceration and reentry work, for 17 and a half years. So post-reentry, in 2004, I began doing this work at a similar organization to Fortune. You know, as a line staff person, I was a counselor, you know, meeting with the individuals, you know, coming through our doors and, you know, helping them to get their lives on track, to stay out of trouble. At the time, I was working primarily with young people. And as time went on, you know, I was promoted in the organization where I originally worked. I began to do a lot more work on advocacy issues. You know, one that was really close to my heart because, you know, I was charged and then ultimately convicted as an adult, beginning at age 17, was the Raise the Age campaign.
Tell us about Raise the Age. I know people are familiar with the phrase, but give us a sense of what it entails.
Sure. So New York was one of the last two states that automatically charged 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. And so, you know, you'd be processed through adult jail, ultimately go away to adult prison as young as age 16. And so Raise the Age was about raising the age of criminal responsibility. And though many of us in the advocacy world feel as though the age of criminal responsibility should be higher than it is, it was raised to age 18. So now if you're 16 or 17 years old, you wouldn't be automatically charged as an adult, although there are circumstances under which you could be. But 16 and 17-year-olds are no longer held in adult detention centers and are no longer sentenced to adult prisons because of the success of the Raise the Age campaign and the legislation being passed.
And that wasn't very long ago either that we managed to win this reform, was it?
No, it was just in 2018. So it was passed in 17 and in 2018 enacted for the 16-year-olds and then a year later in 2019 for 17-year-olds. So it's very recent.
Is there any sense yet as to whether or not that has made a positive difference for the folks who are just kids?
I'll tell you this. Looking at the conditions going on every day in the news right now on Rikers Island, while I'm, very concerned, alarmed for the men and women that are being held there today, to have had young kids there unsupervised and just under these conditions would have been a real, real travesty. Mm-hmm. So that in itself is one significant difference. But in juvenile facilities, there's more investment in the young people in terms of, educational opportunities, not having a conviction, stay on their records for the rest of their lives and those kinds of things. So it does make a huge difference to be charged as a juvenile than as an adult.
And you've worked on another initiative that has another catchphrase that people are familiar with but might not completely understand, ban the box. How does that work?
Yes. So ban the box was something that evolved into the Fair Chance Act. It started as, advocates looking to remove the box on job applications that asked whether or not you were convicted of a crime, if you were ever convicted of a crime or convicted of a crime within the past 10 years. And what it did was, it gave employers a means of screening folks out even before they got to sit in front of them and meet with them and give them an opportunity to make their case for right. why they're the best person for the job. And so, getting the box off the application was, a success. But then ultimately the Fair Chance Act of New York, it does a lot more to make it so that individuals are not discriminated against by employers simply based on the fact that, they've been involved in the criminal justice system, have had a conviction. Mm-hmm. So, that's one that I'm also really proud of course, of having had some involvement in.
As you well should be. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about the debate and the current crisis at Rikers is that it comes amid a lot of these reforms. It seemed for a while that we were moving ahead in a direction that at least made places of detention more humane. There was efforts to try to curb solitary. There were these, as you've described, to keep young people out of it, to take notice that they, were not fully formed adults yet and keep them out of the worst conditions. And yet we now have at Rikers something which seems to be every bit as bad as it ever was. Do you have any sense how many people were being held at Rikers back when you were there?
When I was on Rikers Island, I think the numbers were upwards of 15,000. Could have been more. I'm not absolutely sure, but we're talking about the early 90s,
right?
When I was on Rikers Island.
And now?
And so since then, it's been a bit of a roller coaster. So at the height of the pandemic, we were able to get the numbers of individuals detained on Rikers Island down to about 3,800. Since then, those numbers have gone up again. And so we're currently detaining upwards of 6,000 people on Rikers Island today.
So it's less than half of what it was, and yet there's an added problem there. I mean, before we talk about staffing, which is one of the issues, you estimated when we were talking the other day that somewhere around 40% of the people being held at Rikers have what you call M status. What is M status?
So it's more than that, Tom. So roughly half of the folks on Rikers Island have an M designation. I believe the number is like 49%, meaning that they are diagnosed as having a history of mental illness. And, you know, those individuals who have, you know, histories of mental illness, the mentally ill, the seriously mentally ill, you know, they don't belong in this system at all. So this isn't the system where, you know, we should be treating mental illness with bars and circumstances that actually, you know, enhance or make the conditions worse for an individual, you know, who's dealing with, you know, anything from, you know, paranoid schizophrenia to serious post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a big part of the problem with the balloon and the census is that so many of the folks there, you know, have mental health challenges and don't belong there at all.
And do you have any sense as to whether or not that proportion, almost half, as you said, of the folks, is that similar to what you recall when you were being held there back in the 90s, or is it your sense that it's a lot higher?
Well, I assume that back then we did a lot less work around identifying individuals with, you know, mental health needs. And so it's, you know, very well possible that the numbers were the same then.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think it's just really important to note that, you know, if you treat someone with mental illness and you introduce them to the opportunity to live, you know, to address whatever those challenges are, the probability, the likeliness that they would, you know, continue to exhibit, you know, these negative behaviors that are manifesting themselves because they're not being treated, et cetera, you know, those would decrease. You know, but instead, you know, on Rikers Island, I believe it's the biggest, it's the biggest provider of mental health services in New York.
Right. Right. And not equipped to provide it either. I mean, once
just not equipped to be doing so.
So once someone is labeled with an M designation, there is at least an effort to try to give them some assistance down the road. But are they still in general population at that point? Are they with everybody else?
So they are right in, you know, the general population with everyone else. There are, you know, some, you know, there are some units, and particularly in state prisons, where individuals with severe mental illness are held.
Right, the states have them, but what about at Rikers? Do they segregate people off and try to get them someplace with them?
If folks are segregated on Rikers Island, you know, for struggling with mental health challenges, you know, not enough of it is being done. So many folks with, you know, mental health challenges are right within our, you know, in the general population.
Is that one of the biggest hurdles that you see what's going on at this point and why we have the current crisis in Rikers?
I mean, the current crisis on Rikers, I would say, is the result of, you know, a perfect storm. So, you know, just imagine, you know, a pandemic hitting. And then when this pandemic hits, the number of individuals or the number of organizations, service providers, going into the facilities just, you know, it was brought down to zero. So no one's able to go into the facility to provide services. And then you have 30% of the workforce not available either because, you know, they're sick, they're on modified duty, or they're AWOL. And so, you know, all of these factors, like I said, put together, wind up being a perfect storm and give us what we have now, which is Rikers Island on national and international news.
Right, where they're asking for federal attention to it. Let me just remind people, this is WBAI-FM 99.5. The show is called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, but I'm talking to Rob DeLeon, a senior vice president at the Fortune Society, who had up-close experience with the criminal justice system himself and now is working to bring change. Rob DeLeon, what does the Fortune Society think should be done with Rikers at this point?
You know, Fortune is of the belief, just like everyone else, or most of the advocates, that you hear that the place needs to be closed. It's city policy that Rikers Island will be closed by 2027 or 26. And yeah, we need to accelerate that. We need to accelerate the process of closing Rikers Island. Because those conditions, they're decades worth of festering conditions that, you know, we believe is not fixable. We believe it's something that's just, you know, ingrained in the layout of the place. And, you know, closing it and moving to a more humane system of pretrial detention where, you know, individuals are humanized and, the culture is, you know, shifted to that of human, humanizing the people that are not just held there, but that work there. You know, that would make such a difference in, you know, the justice system or the, you know, the criminal legal system that we know here in New York City.
And do you think that creating, I mean, the mayor's plan, which, I mean, he endorsed really a plan that was put together by city council and other people, but the plan currently calls for creating new facilities in each of the boroughs except for Staten Island. Do you think that that will enable the kind of changes in treatment that you're talking about?
I do, because you know, beside, you know, the years of corruption and just inhumane conditions that have existed, you know, it's an outdated space. So you have really old buildings that need to be taken down. It's built primarily on landfill there in this manufactured island. And so I think that and then putting these facilities right in the communities, right, that individuals are from, where you know, they're closest to, you know, their support systems, they're closest to, you know, community supports like, you know, clergy and you know, family members, etc. That would help with, you know, the humanizing factor that I speak about.
But that would also require a physical redesign of the layout as well. I'm sitting here in a studio which is really right down Atlantic Avenue from the old Brooklyn House of Detention. I hope you never spent any time there.
No, I've not.
You know, that was,
but I'm all too familiar with it and with individuals who have.
And that doesn't really meet the kind of descriptions that you're just talking about what's needed for a more community-based facility, does it?
Absolutely not. There has to be an investment on our part to move, our system away from, you know, Rikers Island into a more humane system. So there does have to be an investment to really do away with, you know, this culture of violence.
There's going to be a new mayor next year who this will land on his desk. There's going to, one way or another, it's going to be a guy. And Eric Adams is the likely person to have to take this on. Is there any sense that you had or that the Fortune Society has gotten as to where he stands on the future of Rikers? Is he foreclosing it down and building up new community facilities?
What I do know is that if we're speaking particularly to Eric Adams, is that he has said outright that this can't be our legacy, Rikers Island, and, you know, its conditions and, you know, just the way it is can't be our legacy as a city. So that's as much as I know about his intentions. Mm-hmm. But we're hopeful that, you know, he does, of course, he does see what's going on there now, but, you know, we're hopeful that he'll agree that this is the way out of this system, which is a much smaller system, which is, you know, community jails with, you know, much smaller census in each of them, with, you know, much more of an investment in terms of, you know, the human services being there and, you know, the community-based organizations having access to them. Family members having access to their family members. You know, this is definitely, you know, a better plan than what we have now.
And it exists elsewhere, right? Even though we've never been able to come close to doing it in New York City, this supposedly forward-looking progressive town. But they do have detention facilities that meet the kind of description that you're talking about in other places, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we look at, you know, some models in Europe, in Norway, where, you know, they're light years ahead of us in the kind of system that we have. But, you know, they give us hope that, you know, where individuals have cooking facilities where they have their knives and stuff at their disposal and, you know, are furloughed to be around their families. While they're serving their sentences and while they're, you know, while they're being incarcerated. So, you know, we look to those systems for hope, of course, but we also look to them as models.
That's certainly the good note to focus on, the issue of hope. And yet, you know, when we were trying to get the administration to endorse the idea of closing Rikers, there was a lot of activity in the street, wasn't there, to try to sort of loosen that up and get politicians to accept the idea? Do we need to do that again? Is that part of the process here?
I mean, you know, we're going to continue to ring the bell of how important, how much more important it is now that we close Rikers. You know, what we're seeing isn't something new. While the staff not being there and all of the conditions that, you know, are brought on by, in large part by the pandemic, you know, are added. But conditions at Rikers Island, like I said, have been festering for decades, and there's a spotlight on it right now, but it's nothing new. So Rikers Island has been, you know, this, you know, black eye on our city for a very, very long time. So, you know, there's just much more attention on it than there's ever been. And I think that in itself is motivating a lot more folks to get involved in the, you know, the push to close Rikers down. But, yeah, we're going to continue to push for it. We're going to continue to advocate. We're going to continue to, you know, raise our voices about the need to make it happen as soon as possible.
All right. Well, I'm glad to end on that note of hope and aspiration. Rob DeLeon, Senior Vice President at the Fortune Society, overseeing programming and public policy. I want to thank you so much for taking the time this evening and walking us through both your own experience and your ideas and hopes of what's happening now.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Take care, everyone. We'll let Eddie Lockjaw Davis steal the last few moments of this show with Stolen Moments by Oliver Nelson. Take care, everyone. See you next week. Thank you.
What follows is a WBAI emergency alert. All listeners who are members of WBAI need to vote now in the local station board delegates election. So far, only a tiny percentage of WBAI listener members have voted, and there's very little time to go before all the ballots are due. WBAI is in danger of failing to make the 10% quorum required in this election. If it fails to make a quorum, other members of Pacifica will think that our listeners don't care about WBAI, and we know that's not the case. Don't encourage BAI naysayers who shut down the station 2 years ago. Vote now. If you can't find